Father in heaven, you are the same God that delivered the Israelites from their oppressors and led them through the wilderness, even in their rebellion and their disobedience and their unfaithfulness. You have always been with them, and from them you have given us salvation. You have given us your Son, Jesus, from within that nation, Israel. You sustained them, even though they were not worthy of your blessing and protection. You made sure they would continue, and you continue to grow your people and your kingdom through places like Hoadley Evangelical Missionary Church and so many millions of congregations around the world, small and large, where your name is being proclaimed and your news is shared that we have an eternal glory, which is our ultimate hope. And I pray that as we go through this series and in a difficult section of Scripture, that you would guide us by your Spirit and teach us and give us wisdom. We pray through Jesus. Amen. So today we begin a journey, and it's a journey with the Israelites as they enter the Promised Land. This land is a land that was called Canaan at one point, but also called the Promised Land. And the reason that it was called the Promised Land is because of a promise that God made to Abraham over 400, maybe even close to 500 years before the Israelites approached the border of the Promised Land, the events of Joshua, hundreds of years prior, a promise was made. In order for us to be rightly oriented as we enter the book of Joshua, we need to take a journey back all the way to the beginning through the story of how we got here. This is really important because we need to be grounded in where we're at. Genesis begins with the creation of everything. We know this. It's very familiar to us. God made all things good, including humanity. He put them in a place called the Garden of Eden. It was paradise. And these first humans were made in God's image, men and women. In Genesis 1, verse 26 to 27, we read that God said, "Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. It cannot be overstated the importance of knowing what it means to be made in the image of God. And so we need to constantly be reminded of it. In ancient times, people understood things like the sun or stars or human-made idols as images of the gods. When God said not to make idols in his image or worship images made by human hands, it was because the only image made in the likeness of him was humanity. We are the idols of God, made by God himself. He made idols of himself, and only he can. And we are those objects. Not as objects of worship, but as the embodied representatives of God. Being made in his image means not only that we look like God, somehow, but that we are made to behave like God, sort of like living statues. We were created to not only show the outward likeness of God, but also his character. We're created to remind one another and the rest of creation of God, to love and create and care in imitation of him. We are to help one another know God. and just give a moment for Oriella to make her way out. Sorry. Oriella also is made in the image of God. We are to help one another know God, to imitate his loving and creative nature in relationship with one another, just as he lives eternally in relationship as Father, Son, and Spirit. God's intention was that everything humanity did would be done the way that he would do it. And this was the design from the beginning, and it was very good. It was perfect until humanity failed. The failure came when we took for ourselves what was not given to us. Being image bearers was not enough. We don't want to merely represent God. We want to be God. And in our attempt at grasping what is not ours, the feeling of incompleteness, of not having enough, has become part of human nature. Every human is now born with a sense of longing for more, wanting what we don't have. And we think that we can satisfy this longing by getting what is not ours. And so we strive and we chase things down. Instead of perfect peace, we live unsatisfied, always wanting. And this brokenness creates things like fear and striving and jealousy, lust, shame, disease, greed, hatred, domination, violence, and death. This desire, this unfulfillment that we feel is the source of all things gone wrong in the world. Instead of displaying the image and character of God, humanity turned on one another. And it got so bad that God started over. He chose one faithful man and his family to reset humanity. This man was still broken, but Noah was the sort of broken that could still be recognized as God's image, unlike just about everyone else. Genesis 6 says that the Lord saw how great the wickedness of humanity was, and every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart were only evil all the time. That's how humanity was described. But it says Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. So he had still some remnant of God's image, his character, and so God chose him and saved him and his family. And then fast forward to Genesis 12, we come to the story of Abraham. He was one of the descendants of Noah's son, Shem. If you ever wonder why we call Jewish people Semites, it's because that comes from the name Shem. They are the Semites. Abraham was called by God to be the seed of a tree, dedicated to produce the fruit of a new humanity. I threw that statement in my notes yesterday, I think it was, or the day before. I just had this image in my mind of a tree, and I never had that image through all my preparations, and as I was thinking about this series, it never came to me until the last minute, and it has quickly, over the last 24 hours or so, become a central image that I think we need to keep in our minds. Abraham was called by God to be the seed of a tree. And the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are often referred to as the roots of a tree, of an olive tree. And he was to be the seed of a tree that would be dedicated to producing the fruit of a new humanity. So just hold that image in your mind. I'm not going to develop that a whole lot in this message because it just came in too late, but it'll come up again and again. I'm going to bring this image of this tree. But it's a valuable image to to have in our minds. God's plan was not to restart over again, like he did with Noah. His plan was to heal and restore his image bearers and his creation. And this was going to happen within creation itself. Not imposed on creation, but in participation with creation and with humanity. The healing would come from within, ultimately in the person of Jesus. Abraham and his family were called out of their homeland to go to a place that God would show them. God led them to a land where some of the descendants of Noah's son Ham were living, known as the Canaanites. And this was the descendants of Ham were, especially the Canaanites, were said to be cursed because of something that Ham did. And you can go back in Genesis 9 and 10, and you can read those stories. But so the Canaanites were living in this land, and God brought Abraham and his family to this land. And in Genesis 12, verse 7, as Abraham was there, we read that the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." And so Abraham built an altar to the Lord there. And he dedicated that place to God, and with the intention that he would be back, or his family would be back, and worship God there. But the land was not yet ready for Abraham's family to take possession of it. Genesis 15, verse 12 to 16 says that Abraham had a dream in which God said to him, "Your offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not theirs, and shall be slaves there, and they shall be oppressed for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." So just a side note, in addition to Canaan, the Canaanites being descendants of Ham, so was the nation of Egypt. So a little bit of a connection there if you've never known that. There was animosity between the descendants of these brothers, Ham and Shem. Japheth was out in Europe somewhere doing his own thing, north and west, and eventually became the European nations, notably Rome. And so there's a whole other story. But if you're ever interested in that, it's very fascinating to learn about the history of the nations and how all that developed. But Ham, out of Ham came Egypt as well as Canaan. And God tells Abraham that his descendants will be slaves of this nation. But he will rescue them. And he says, "As for yourself, you shall go to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they, your descendants, will come back here in the fourth generation. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." So the Amorites would be sort of a catch-all term for the people who lived in that land called Canaan. So God's plan was for Abraham's descendants to possess that land, but more time needed to pass. And the reason given was that the people who lived there in that land were not yet deserving of the judgment that was to come. Interesting reason. That's what it says. So it's hard to make sense of that. That's not our focus today, but something that if you're interested, we can work through that. If enough people are interested, I can do some writing on it. But God's intention was to bring judgment on the land, on the people, and their judgment was not yet deserving. And so time needed to pass, like almost 500 years. And so then Abraham and his family, his sons and grandsons and all their wives and children and livestock and servants, probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of people, who knows how many people were part of that big group, they moved from place to place until they ended up in Egypt during a terrible famine. So now we've gone through the generations, and we're at Abraham's grandson Jacob, also called Israel, and he and his family moved to Egypt during the famine. And we know the story of Joseph and all that happened. And the Lord sustained this family. He showed them favor and caused them to grow large in number. And after several generations, out of fear, the ruler of Egypt enslaved the Israelites, afraid that they would rise up against them. And just as was spoken by the Lord to Abraham in his dream, they were enslaved for hundreds of years. And a few hundred years later, the Lord called a man named Moses, who was an Israelite but was raised in Pharaoh's household. He was called by the Lord to lead the people out of slavery and bring them to the land that was promised to Abraham's descendants. And so Moses obeyed the Lord, and the Israelites were liberated from their oppressors. And after a dramatic exodus, the people were brought to a mountain called Sinai. These were people who knew nothing except slavery. So their generations before them, they were slaves. They grew up as slaves. That's all they knew. But they did know about this God, the God of their ancestors, and the God now known to them as Yahweh. It was the name revealed to Moses at this very mountain before he went to deliver the Israelites from Egypt. So they knew about him, but they were ruled for many generations by people who worshipped other gods, people who did not know Yahweh. See, the world at that time was polytheistic. They believed in and worshipped multiple gods. Everybody did. It was normal. So probably the Israelites would have been considered polytheistic at the time. Abraham was at the time when God called him. He was a worshiper of many gods. And probably the Israelites were. They probably participated in some of the worship of other gods as well. It was just a normal part of their life. But Yahweh gave instructions at Mount Sinai to Moses, and then Moses passed them to the Israelites, told them how to live as his people and how to worship him alone, no other gods, and ultimately how to grow into this tree that would bear the fruit of a new humanity. These were the instructions that God gave Israel at Mount Sinai. In Exodus 19, verse 3 to 6, we read that Moses went up to the mountain, and Yahweh gave him a message to share with the Israelites. And the message was this. This is just a short portion. He says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." The idea of a priestly kingdom was that they would begin the process of reconciliation, of bringing God and humanity close together again. That's the activity of the priests, to bring God and people together. And the idea of being a holy nation was not that they would be perfect, but that they would be set apart, dedicated to the Lord. And this was their purpose. And they got off to a bit of a rough start, because as Moses was up on that mountain receiving these instructions, the impatience and fear of the Israelites got the best of them, and they decided they would seek guidance from a different god, a god made out of gold, a god of their own design to serve their own purposes. Now, this wouldn't have been like a huge rebellion at the time. They were still, you know, pretty new at this whole monotheism thing, worshiping only one God. And so the idea of creating another God for themselves was probably pretty logical for most people. But God explicitly told them just before this not to do that. And so they immediately went to their old ways and sought after something that was not given to them, once again, as is the case with humanity. After being rebuked by Moses, they repented and rededicated themselves to the exclusive worship of Yahweh. And this would be just the first of many rebellious acts along the way on a long and difficult journey before they would arrive at the promised land. Due to their lack of trust in Yahweh, early in their journey toward Canaan, the generation that was rescued from Egypt would not live to see the land. God said, "That's it." Like, the last straw has come, and I am not going to allow this generation to enter the land. Rather, their children would be the ones to possess it. And so Yahweh kept them from arriving at the land until everyone in that generation had died, all except for two, Caleb and Joshua. These two trusted Yahweh when no one else did. They were confident that he would fulfill his promises, that he would deliver the land into their hands, and that he would keep his promise to Abraham. And so they were called faithful, and they were allowed to enter, not only allowed, but they were given special prominence. Joshua as the leader that would lead them into the promised land, and Caleb was given a special inheritance. When the last of the generation had died, Yahweh handed leadership over from Moses to Joshua. And Deuteronomy ends this way. Joshua, son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands on him, and the Israelites obeyed him, doing as the Lord had commanded Moses. Never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. So, with that overview of the Pentateuch and the story leading up to this point, let's turn now to Joshua chapter 1. And I am going to read a little bit at a time, and I want to stop to point a few things out for us to consider. So let me start Joshua chapter 1, I'll just read the first couple verses and then stop and make some comments. So after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give them to the Israelites. So Yahweh, whenever you see the Lord, and different Bibles will portray it differently, but whenever it's all small caps, it's representing the name of God, Yahweh. The Lord is speaking now directly to Moses, to Joshua. He was speaking directly to Moses until now, and the torch has been passed down to Joshua, and now Yahweh and Joshua are speaking directly. And the first message from Yahweh to Israel through Joshua is in verses 3 to 4. It's not a very long message. This is the first message. He says, I will give you, and this is plural, okay? You in this, in these verses is plural. We don't see it in English. I'll give y'all. There's actually a y'all version. Did you know that? Someone here told me that. Who was it? Keaton. Keaton said, you know, there's a y'all version. You can, on the Bible app, you can find it. It's actually quite interesting. It makes some of the verses that previously were very serious, like, you know, sound kind of not as serious for some reason. Anyway, so I will give you all, you, the nation of Israel, every place where you all set your foot. As I promised Moses, your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. So that's sort of a general area that they are going to now inhabit. And God said, this is what I'm going to give you all as a nation. And so, yeah, these verses were spoken to a group of people. I always try to imagine how Moses did this, and now Joshua. How did they address all of these people all at once? Because there's a lot of people there. We don't know, but it's fun to imagine. They didn't have speakers like this, so. Now, before we go further, I want us to be mindful of something here and through the entire series as we continue to read through these books of Joshua and Judges. These are difficult books. These are challenging because they portray stories that don't seem to be aligned with how we think that God should behave. I can say lots about this in my midweek kind of writings that I'm going to be doing. I should maybe mention that. So on Tuesday, I'm going to do a letter, my regular kind of letter. And then another point in the week, and I don't have a promise of when that's going to be, I'll publish, and it's not going to go out by email, so because I don't want to bombard everybody with emails constantly. But you can go on my website, and you can find, there will be supplemental material that is helpful and important, but there's no space in the sermons to cover a lot of these things. And so one of the things that I'll cover is addressing this issue of, like, what sort of stuff is this in the Bible that is portraying God as giving instructions to kill people? Like, it doesn't sit right with us. So I'm going to address some of that in those publications in a little more detail. So if you're just curious, but we need to be mindful as we read these stories that the instructions and promises given in this material are for Israel and for Joshua. It's for a particular people at a particular time, for a particular purpose. And my invitation and challenge for you as we journey through these stories is not to ask, what does this mean for me? That's a very, that question to ask, like, what does this mean for me? It's a very kind of new development in the church and how to read the Bible. It's not something that for most of history people would have ever asked. It's not about what it means for me. Rather, what does this say about God? That's really what it's about. It's about God. How do we know God better through these stories? And so keep that in mind as I read this next portion, because you're going to recognize some of these verses. The question again is, it's not what does this mean for me, but what does this say about God? So let me keep reading, and now we shift from plural to singular. So now from verse 5 to 9, this is Yahweh speaking to Joshua directly. So all the yous and yours are singular. So he says to Joshua, "No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you." Sound familiar, doesn't it? We claim that for ourselves. "Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go." So this is God giving instruction and promises to Joshua. This is a conversation. This is an intimate moment between Yahweh and the leader of the nation of Israel that is about to enter into a land where it seems impossible. Again, this is nomadic people. They've been wandering in the desert for 40 years in the wilderness. They've been living off of magical bread that fell from the sky and birds that flew into their camp. They've been living off of nothing. They've been scraping by. They're probably pretty rugged people, but they're surely not trained as military people. They're former, they're kids of slaves. And they're supposed to go into this land and possess it. Take it from the people that are living there. Like, good luck. Seems like a very bad idea. And so God and Joshua are meeting, and God is saying, "Don't be afraid. I'm going before you. I will be with you the whole time. be courageous, be strong and courageous, lead these people with confidence in me that I will bring this land into your hands. And we can easily claim these. We can look at it, and we look at, especially at this verse 5, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, is that a true statement for all of us? Absolutely. Absolutely it is. It's actually, we know it's true because it's spoken elsewhere. Jesus said it to his disciples, and it's a promise we can claim for ourselves. But we don't claim it because it's here in this passage. We claim it because it's true about God. It's something about God. And we got to be careful when we read these passages, and there's lots more in Joshua and Judges, we're going to read, that are difficult or that we may be tempted to claim for ourselves. And we need to be mindful not to claim things for ourselves that were not spoken to us, that were not given as covenantal, eternal promises from God to us. This was a promise from God to Joshua. And what it does is it tells us something about God. It's something about how he is going to be the one to deliver the land into their hands. It's not going to be Joshua. It's not going to be his strategic mind or his power. It'll be Yahweh. That's what this tells us. So it tells us something about what sort of God is bringing Israel into the promised land. And this is an issue that we commonly have when we read the Bible, as though it is a moral guide or an instruction manual for life. This is an unfortunate product of evangelicalism to treat the Bible as an instruction manual where it contains, you know, it's everything in the Bible is something for me. But it's not. There are lots of things for you. There are lots of pieces of instruction. But not every verse and every statement in the Bible is something that you can apply to your life. Some of it needs to be just looked at and help, and it helps you understand God and who God is. And so that's going to be very much the case in these books. It's very important that we understand that. So we need discernment in how we interpret the Bible. And so my invitation to you is to receive these words as part of the larger story, as the revelation of God's character and his purposes, which culminates with Jesus. So we take the whole thing in, and we receive it all as an invitation to know God. And as we come to the promised land, the main question will be this: what kind of people can actually possess the land? What kind of people? What sort of tree is this? You know, I talked about a tree that is being grown from the seed of Abraham. What sort of tree is this that that will produce the fruit of a new humanity? What sort of humanity is this meant to be? And we'll learn how to answer that question as we become familiar with God, as revealed in these stories. He is a covenant keeper. He stays faithful in the midst of human unfaithfulness. God went before Israel and he enabled them to possess the land. He is the one who did it. And he didn't do it through domination of the people, as we'll see. It wasn't through domination. It was through dismantling the infrastructure of idolatry. That was his main concern. It wasn't about destroying the people. It was about destroying the infrastructure of idolatry. And one of my goals in the next few months is for you to be able to reconcile the violent stories of Joshua with the nonviolent nature of God as revealed in Jesus Christ, who defeated the enemy not through conquest, but through laying down his life. And this will require a commitment on our part to embrace curiosity in a humble posture, and it maybe even will require us to rewrite some of the narratives that we've come to believe about the God of the Old Testament. At the end of Joshua in 21, verse 43 to 45, we read that the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to their ancestors, that he would give them, and having taken possession of it, they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All had come to pass. And then during the period of the judges, Israel repeatedly abandoned the Lord to serve other gods. Even after all of this, after God delivered the land into their hands, they abandoned him time and time again. And then the Lord delivered them from their enemies into the delivered them from the judgment of their neighboring nations through different leaders called judges. And through it all, he remained present with them, sustaining them. And we'll see throughout this portion of scripture that Yahweh is a God who is all at once powerful and faithful, just and patient, among many other things. He doesn't compromise his holiness. He cannot be corrupted by the unfaithfulness of his people. He wants an embodied presence on earth. He wants to live among his creation, and through Israel, he makes this incrementally possible. The question again is this: what sort of people can possess the land? What sort of people can grow into a tree to bear the fruit of a new humanity? It's the sort of people who are committed above everything else to the unwavering covenant loyalty to Yahweh. Faithfulness. Faithfulness to him. To keep themselves holy by rejecting the religious practices of their neighbors. To submit themselves to Yahweh's instruction rather than trusting in their own understanding or human wisdom. We can see this most concisely in Deuteronomy 6, verse 1 to 9. This is a summary of God's instruction to the nation of Israel, and Moses spoke this sort of at the beginning of a sermon that he gave to them, the last thing he spoke to them. And he says, "These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you, to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you, and so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, Israel, and be careful to obey that, so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands, and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." When Jesus was asked or had a conversation about what is the greatest commandment, this is what he referred to: love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. But then he also said the second greatest commandment is like it and equal to it, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. So love is the purpose. Love is the goal. Love is the way. Love is the fruit of this tree. Toward the end of his life, Moses was providing final instruction for Israel before he handed his leadership over to Joshua. And as they prepared to enter the promised land, this is what he said. These were the final words of instruction, reminding them of what's most important. As we come to the story of Israel possessing the land, promised to them, we must not forget what sort of people God expected them to be. His expectation was to be faithful to him, to follow his instructions, to call upon him and him alone in their times of need and in times of prosperity, to worship him alone, to not adopt the ways of pagan worship that the neighbors were practicing, to dismantle the high places and the objects that the people would worship and through which they would worship their gods, to dismantle these things, to tear them down, to destroy them, so that they could grow to be creation's source of healing. They needed fertile soil, and in order to have fertile soil, they needed to be rid of the weeds of idolatry. Not only the weeds of idolatry that grew among the neighboring nations, but within themselves. And we'll see throughout these stories that it is actually themselves that is the greatest barrier to achieving this goal, not their enemies. It was themselves. If we forget that the purpose of Israel was to be a blessing to the world and to be a vessel for God's reconciliation and renewal plan, the healing of creation, if we forget these things, we can turn the stories of battle and conquest into justification for violence. Every empire and nation that has ever engaged in military conquest in the name of God has read Joshua this way, using the stories of conquest as justification for their own evil intentions. But there is nothing in the scriptures, absolutely nothing. I checked thoroughly. There is nothing in the scriptures, including Joshua and the story of Israel's possession of the promised land, that authorizes the church or any nation to wage military conquest against other nations or people groups. There is nothing that justifies this. I'll say it again. There is nothing in the Bible that authorizes the church or any nation to wage military conquest against other nations or people groups. The story of Israel possessing the promised land through military activity does not tell us how God's power normally works. It describes how power worked in the ancient Near East. It's descriptive, it's not prescriptive. It doesn't tell us what to do, it tells us what happened. It describes the reality of a broken humanity grasping for power. It is not ideal. It is not describing the way that things should be done. It's a reality we still see in large and small ways today. We will see in the coming weeks that God's plan, however, was not conquest, but transformation. Not the conquering of people, but the transformation of a land that would allow the growth of a tree that would produce fruit to heal and renew humanity. In order for that to happen, the land needed to be cleared of the infrastructure of idolatry because it would be a temptation. And so they were to clear it. And it was a one-time event. These sort of instructions were never once given again. It was for these people at that time and is not a pattern to be followed. As we enter the story of Israel possessing the promised land, we'll constantly come back to the question of this series, what sort of people can possess the land? In asking this question, we're really asking, what sort of people can bring the kingdom of God to earth? And the answer is not a violent people, not a people who conquer and dominate, but a people who bring the worship of God, his goodness, his character to the world. In a very serious moment in my sermon, the kids are screaming. I say this because, and some of you know very well, I'm just mindful of the time, but I do need to say this because we're in a bit of an interesting time right now in the world, aren't we? I'm just asking God for discernment in what to say here because I had this all written down and I took it out. Last Sunday there was an event in Washington. Did any of you watch that? It was a rededication event. And I know that some of you will maybe even be hurt by what I'm going to say. But I have never been more ashamed of the church than I was when I watched that. It was embarrassing because the church, or those who call themselves leaders of the church, claimed that God was blessing the violent efforts of the United States through history until now, claiming promises for themselves that were never given to them. And in doing so, made God into a puppet of their own making, of their own design. And so if you watch that or if you hear things about it, just know that that is not the message of the church. I was angry as I watched, but I was just so terribly heartbroken because I know so many people will think that event is the fulfillment of all kinds of prayers and promises. And it is not. It is a church that has lost its way. And we will lose our way if we do not read these books, Joshua and Judges, rightly. We will lose our way when we think that we have to conquer and we have to rule and we have to take positions of power and we have to take land from people and we have to remove people from their land. We will go wrong if we think that we have to be rid of foreigners who are apparently taking advantage of us. We will go wrong if we think that in order for us to display the character of God, we have to be rid of people who don't display the character of God. That was never the intention. That was never the purpose of possessing the land of Canaan. The purpose was to remove the infrastructure of idolatry. And what is the infrastructure of idolatry right now? In our Western world, in our Western church. It is the infrastructure of the church itself. That's the infrastructure of idolatry. The idea that a church can become a nation, that the nation can be ruled by a church, that was never the message of Jesus. In fact, it's the anti-message of Jesus. Jesus did not come to set up political power, but to destroy political power. By not caring about it, by not being concerned about it. And so our response to this in this series is to ask ourselves, what sort of God and what sort of people will bring healing to the world? That's the goal, that's the trajectory that we're headed in. What sort of God and what sort of people can bring healing to the world? We need to search these stories for the answer to that question. If you choose to read through the books of Joshua and Judges over the course of this series, and I encourage you to do that, keep two things in mind as you read. First, read it to become familiar with the story. It's the same thing I said about the Gospels. This needs to be the default posture whenever we read the Bible. We jump too quickly to application. We need to simply be familiar with the story. Before we do anything, if we do anything with what we find in the Bible, we need to be familiar with it. We need to know it. And second, the second thing I want you to do as you read is to ask God to help you to know him better. He is revealed in these stories. But we need to set aside any notion of being able to apply these things to our lives. We need to set that aside in the time being so that we can take enough time and have enough space to get to know God in these stories. His revelation from beginning to the end reveals a God that never changes. His plan is still working itself out. And he's inviting us, this church, to participate with him in bearing the fruit of a new humanity. We are grafted into that tree. We are a part of the plan. To close, I want to read a poem that I'm not going to explain. Maybe some of you will get it right away. I sure didn't on first reading. But this is the thing with poems. Poems are not meant to be understood, but to be observed, to be heard, to be taken in. And so take whatever is given to you here in this poem. This is written by George Herbert, a gift from a lovely person in the congregation. I love George Herbert's poetry. It's called L'Envoi. I'm not a French person, so whoever speaks French can correct me. It's L'Envoi. It starts this way. King of glory, King of peace, with the one make war to cease, with the other bless thy sheep. Thee to love and thee to sleep. Let not sin devour thy fold, bragging that thy blood is cold, that thy death is also dead, while his conquests daily spread. That thy flesh hath lost his food, and thy cross is common wood. Choke him, let him say no more, but reserve his breath in store till thy conquests and his fall make his sighs to use it all. And then bargain with the wind to discharge what is behind. Blessed be God alone, thrice blessed, three in one.